Only when he had finished a layer and covered it carefully and patted down the salt was she satisfied. She dried her bleached and bloated hands. Tom said, "Ma, what stuff we gonna take from here?" She looked quickly about the kitchen. "The bucket," she said. "All the stuff to eat with, plates and the cups, the spoons and knives and forks. Put all them in that drawer, and take the drawer. The big fry pan and the big stew kettle, the coffee pot. When it gets cool, take the rack out of the oven. That's good over a fire. I'd like to take the wash tub, but I guess there ain't room. I'll wash clothes in the bucket. Don't do no good to take little stuff. You can cook little stuff in a big kettle, but you can't cook big stuff in a little pot. Take the bread pans, all of them. They fit down inside each other." She stood and looked about the kitchen. "You just take that stuff I told you, Tom. I'll fix up the rest. The big can of pepper and the salt and the nutmeg and the grater. I'll take all that stuff just at the last." She picked up a lantern and walked heavily into the bedroom, and her bare feet made no sound on the floor. The preacher said, "She looks tired." "Women's always tired," said Tom. "That's just the way women is, except at meetin' once and again."
"Yep, but tarder than that. Real tired. Like she's sick tired."
Ma was just through the door, and she heard his words. Slowly her relaxed face tightened, and the lines disappeared from the taut, muscular face. Her eyes sharpened, and her shoulders straightened. She glanced about the stripped room. Nothing was left in it except trash. The mattresses which had been on the floor were gone. The bureaus were sold. On the floor lay a broken comb, an empty talcum powder can, and a few dust mice. Ma set her lantern on the floor. She reached behind one of the boxes that had served as chairs and brought out a stationery box, old and soiled and cracked at the corners. She sat down and opened the box. Inside were letters, clippings, photographs, a pair of earrings, a little gold signet ring, and a watch chain braided of hair and tipped with gold swivels. She touched the letters with her fingers, touched them lightly, and she smoothed a newspaper clipping on which there was an account of Tom's trial. For a long time she held the box, looking over it, and her fingers disturbed the letters and then lined them up again. She bit her lower lip, thinking, remembering. And at last she made up her mind. She picked out the ring, the watch charm, the earrings, dug under the pile and found one gold cufflink. She took a letter from an envelope and dropped the trinkets in the envelope. She folded the envelope over and put it in her dress pocket. Then gently and tenderly, she closed the box and smoothed the top carefully with her fingers. Her lips parted, and then she stood up, took her lantern, and went back into the kitchen. She lifted the stove lid and laid the box gently among the coals. Quickly, the heat browned the paper. A flame licked up and over the box. She replaced the stove lid, and instantly the fire sighed up and breathed over the box. Out in the dark yard, working in the lantern light, Pa and Al loaded the truck. Tools on the bottom, but handy to reach in case of a breakdown. Boxes of clothes next, and kitchen utensils in a gunny sack, cutlery and dishes in their box. Then the gallon bucket tied on behind. They made the bottom of the load as even as possible and filled the spaces between boxes with rolled blankets. Then over the top they laid the mattresses, filling the truck in level. And last, they spread the big tarpaulin over the load, and Al made holes in the edge 2 feet apart and inserted little ropes and tied it down to the side bars of the truck.
"Now, if it rains," he
he said. We'll tie it to the bar above, and the folks can get underneath out of the wet. Up front, we'll be dry enough. And Pa applauded.
That's a good idea.
That ain't all, Al said. First chance I get, I'm going to find a long plank and make a ridgepole, and put the tarp over that. And then it'll be covered in, and the folks will be out of the sun, too.
And Pa agreed. That's a good idea. Why didn't you think of that before?
I ain't had time, said Al.
Ain't had time. Why, Al, you had time to coyote all over the country. God knows where you been this last 2 weeks.
Stuff a fella gotta do when he's leaving the country, said Al,
and then he lost some of his assurance.
Pa, he asked, you glad to be going, Pa?
Huh? Well, sure. Leastwise, yeah, we had hard times here. Of course, it'll be all different out there. Plenty work and everything nice and green and little white houses and oranges growing around.
Is it all oranges everywhere?
Well, maybe not everywhere, but plenty places.
The first gray of daylight began in the sky, and the work was done. The kegs of pork ready, the chicken coop ready to go on top. Ma opened the oven and took out the pile of roasted bones, crisp and brown, with plenty of gnawing meat left. Ruthie half awakened and slipped down from the box and slept again. But the adults stood around the door, shivering a little and gnawing at the crisp pork.
Guess we ought to wake up Grandma and Grandpa, Tom said. Getting along on toward day.
Ma said, kinda hate to, till the last minute. They need the sleep. Ruthie and Winfield ain't hardly got no real rest neither.
Well, they can all sleep on top of the load, said Pa. It'll be nice and comfortable there.
Suddenly the dogs started up from the dust and listened, and then with a roar went barking off into the darkness.
Now what in hell is that?
Pa demanded. In a moment they heard a voice speaking reassuringly to the barking dogs, and the barking lost its fierceness. Then footsteps, and a man approached. It was Muley Graves, his hat pulled low. He came near timidly.
"Morning, folks," he said.
"Why, Muley,"
Pa waved the ham bone he held.
"Step in and get some pork for yourself, Muley."
"Well, no," said Muley. I ain't hungry, exactly.
Oh, get it, Muley, get it.
Here. And Pa stepped into the house and brought out a hand of spare ribs.
I wasn't aiming to eat none of your stuff, he said. I was just walking around. I thought how you'd be going, and I'd maybe say goodbye.
Going in a little while now, said Pa. You'd have missed us if you'd come an hour later. All packed up, see?
All packed up.
Muley looked at the loaded truck.
Sometimes I wish I'd go and find my folks.
Ma asked, did you hear from them out in California?
Nope, said Muley. I ain't heard. But I ain't been to look in the post office. I ought to go in sometimes.
Pa said, Al, go down, wake up Grandma, Grandpa.
Tell them to come and eat. We're going before long.
And as Al sauntered toward the barn,
Muley, you want to squeeze in with us and go? We'd try to make room for you.
Muley took a bite of meat from the edge of a rib bone and chewed it.
Sometimes I think I might, but I know I won't, he said. I know perfectly well last minute I'd run and hide like a damn old graveyard ghost.
Noah said,
you gonna die out in the field someday, Muley.
I know. I thought about that. Sometimes it seems pretty lonely. Sometimes it seems all right. Sometimes it seems good. It don't make no difference. But if you come across my folks, that's really what I come to say. If you come on any of my folks in California, tell them I'm well. Tell them I'm doing all right. Don't let on I'm living this way. Tell them I'll come to them as soon as I get the money.
Ma asked, and will you?
No,
Muley said softly.
No, I won't. I can't go away. I gotta stay now. Time back I might have went, but not now. Fella gets to thinking, and he gets to knowing. I ain't never going.
The light of the dawn was a little sharper now. It paled the lanterns a little. Al came back with Grandpa struggling and limping by his side.
He wasn't sleeping, Al said. He was setting out back of the barn. There's something wrong with him.
Grandpa's eyes had dulled, and there was none of the old meanness in them.
Ain't nothing the matter with me, he said. I just ain't a-going.
Not going? Pa demanded.
What you mean you ain't a-going? Why, here we're all packed up, ready. We got to go. We got no place to stay.
I ain't saying for you to stay, said Grandpa. You go right on along me, I'm staying. I give her a going over all night, mostly. This here's my country. I belong here. And I don't give a goddamn if there's oranges and grapes crowding a fella out of bed, even. I ain't a-going. This country ain't no good, but it's my country. Now you all go ahead. I'll just stay right here where I belong.
They crowded near to him. Pa said,
You can't, Grandpa. This here land is going under the tractors. Who'd cook for you? How'd you live? You can't stay here. Why, with nobody to take care of you, you'd starve.
Grandpa cried,
God damn it! I'm an old man, but I can still take care of myself. How's Muley here get along? I can get along as good as him. I tell you, I ain't going, and you can lump it. Take Grandma with you if you want, but you ain't taking me, and that's the end of it.
Pa said helplessly,
Now, listen to me, Grandpa. Just listen a minute, just a minute.
Ain't you gonna listen? I told you what I'm gonna do.
Tom touched his father on the shoulder. Pa, come in the house. I want to tell you something. And as they moved toward the house, he called, Ma, come here a minute, will you? In the kitchen, one lantern burned and the plate of pork bones was still piled high. Tom said,
Listen, I know Grandpa got the right to say he ain't going, but he can't stay. We know that.
Sure he can't stay, said Pa.
Well, look, if we gotta catch him and tie him down, we liable to hurt him, and he'll get so mad he'll hurt himself. Now we can't argue with him. If we could get him drunk, it'd be all right. You got any whiskey?
No, said Pa. There ain't a drop of whiskey in the house. And John got no whiskey, never has none when he ain't drinking.
Ma said, Tom, I got a half a bottle soothing syrup I got for Winfield when he had them earaches. Think that might work? Used to put Winfield to sleep when his earache was bad.
Might, said Tom.
Get it, Ma. We'll give her a try anyways. I throwed it out on the trash pile, said Ma. She took the lantern and went out, and in a moment she came back with a bottle half full of black medicine. Tom took it from her and tasted it.
Don't taste bad, he said. Make up a cup of black coffee, good and strong. Let's see, says 1 teaspoon. Better put in a lot, couple of tablespoons.
Ma opened the stove and put a kettle inside, down next to the coals, and she measured water and coffee into it.
Have to give it to him in a can, she said. We got the cups all packed.
Tom and his father went back outside.
Fella got a right to say what he's gonna do. Say, who's eating spare ribs? Said Grandpa.
We vet, said Tom. Ma's fixing you a cup of coffee and some pork.
He went into the house, and he drank his coffee and ate his pork. The group outside in the growing dawn watched him quietly through the door. They saw him yawn and sway, and they saw him put his arms on the table and rest his head on his arms and go to sleep.
He was tarred anyways, said Tom. Leave him be.
Now they were ready. Grandma, giddy and vague, saying,
"What's all this? What you doing now so early?"
But she was dressed and agreeable. And Ruthie and Winfield were awake, but quiet with the pressure of tiredness and still half-dreaming. The light was sifting rapidly over the land, and the movement of the family stopped. They stood about, reluctant to make the first active move to go. They were afraid now that the time had come, afraid in the same way Grandpa was afraid. They saw the shed take shape against the light, and they saw the lanterns pale until they no longer cast their circles of yellow light. The stars went out, few by few, toward the west, and still the family stood about like dreamwalkers, their eyes focused panoramically, seeing no detail but the whole dawn, the whole land, the whole texture of the country at once. Only Muley Graves prowled around restlessly, looking through the bars into the truck, thumping the spare tires hung on the back of the truck, and at last Muley approached Tom.
"You going over the state line?"
he asked.
"You going to break your parole?"
And Tom shook himself free of the numbness.
"Jesus Christ, it's near sunrise," he said loudly. "We got to get going."
And the others came out of their numbness and moved toward the truck. "Come on," Tom said. "Let's get Grandpa on." Pa and Uncle John and Tom and Al went into the kitchen where Grandpa slept, his forehead down on his arms, and a line of drying coffee on the table. They took him under the elbows and lifted him to his feet, and he grumbled and cursed thickly like a drunken man. Out the door they boosted him, and when they came to the truck, Tom and Al climbed up and, leaning over, hooked their hands under his arms and lifted him gently up and laid him on top of the load. Al untied the tarpaulin, and they rolled him under and put a box under the tarp beside him so that the weight of the heavy canvas would not be upon him.
"I gotta get that ridge pole fixed," Al said. "Do it tonight when we stop."
Grandpa grunted and fought weakly against awakening, and when he was finally settled, he went deeply to sleep again. Pa said,
"Ma, you and Grandma sit in with Al for a while. We'll change around so it's easier, but you start out that way."
They got into the cab, and then the rest swarmed up on top of the load, Connie and Rose of Sharon, Pa and Uncle John, Ruthie and Winfield, Tom and the preacher. Noah stood on the ground, looking up at the great load of them sitting on top of the truck. Al walked around, looking underneath at the springs.
"Holy Jesus," he said. "Them springs is flat as hell. Lucky I blocked under 'em."
Noah said, "How about the dogs, Pa?"
"I forgot the dogs," Pa said.
He whistled shrilly, and one bouncing dog ran in, but only one. Noah caught him and threw him up on the top where he sat rigid and shivering at the height.
"Got to leave the other two," Pa called. "Muley, will you look after them some? See they don't starve?"
"Yeah," said Muley. "I like to have a couple dogs. Yeah, I'll take them."
"Take them chickens, too," Pa said.
Al got into the driver's seat. The starter whirred and caught and whirred again. And then the loose roar of the six cylinders and a blue smoke behind.
"So long, Muley,"
Al called. And the family called, "Goodbye, Muley." Al slipped in the low gear and let in the clutch. The truck shuddered and strained across the yard, and the second gear took hold. They crawled up the little hill, and the red dust arose about them.
"Christ, what a load," said Al. "We ain't making no time on this trip."
Ma tried to look back, but the body of the load cut off her view. She straightened her head and peered straight ahead along the dirt road, and a great weariness was in her eyes. The people on top of the load did look back. They saw the house and the barn, and the little smoke still rising from the chimney. They saw the windows reddening under the first color of the sun. They saw Muley standing forlornly in the dooryard looking after them. And then the hill cut them off. The cotton fields lined the road, and the truck crawled slowly through the dust toward the highway and the west. Chapter 11. The houses were left vacant on the land, and the land was vacant because of this. Only the tractor sheds of corrugated iron, silver and gleaming, were alive. And they were alive with metal and gasoline and oil, the discs of the plows shining. The tractors had lights shining, for there is no day and night for a tractor, and the discs turn the earth in the darkness, and they glitter in the daylight. And when a horse stops work and goes into the barn, there is a life and a vitality left. There is a breathing and a warmth, and the feet shift on the straw, and the jaws champ on the hay, and the ears and the eyes are alive. There is a warmth of life in the barn, and the heat and smell of life. But when the motor of a tractor stops, it is as dead as the ore it came from. The heat goes out of it like the living heat that leaves a corpse. Then the corrugated iron doors are closed, and the tractor man drives home to town, perhaps 20 miles away, and he need not come back for weeks or months, for the tractor is dead. And this is easy and efficient, so easy that the wonder goes out of work, so efficient that the wonder goes out of land and the working of it, and with the wonder, the deep understanding and the relation. And in the tractor man there grows the contempt that comes only to a stranger who has little understanding and no relation. For nitrates are not the land, nor phosphates. And the length of fiber in the cotton is not the land. Carbon is not a man, nor salt, nor water, nor calcium. He is all these, but he is much more, much more. And the land is so much more than its analysis. The man who is more than his chemistry, walking on the earth, turning his plow point for a stone, dropping his handles to slide over an outcropping, kneeling in the earth to eat his lunch, that man who is more than his elements knows the land that is more than its analysis. But the machine man, driving a dead tractor on land he does not know and love, understands only chemistry, and he is contemptuous of the land and of himself. When the corrugated iron doors are shut, he goes home, and his home is not the land. The doors of the empty houses swung open and drifted back and forth in the wind. Bands of little boys came out from the towns to break the windows and to pick over the debris, looking for treasures. And here's a knife with half the blade gone. That's a good thing. And smells like a rat died here. And look what Whitey wrote on the wall. He wrote that in the toilet in school, too, and teacher made him wash it off. When the folks first left, and the evening of the first day came, the hunting cats slouched in from the fields and mewed on the porch. And when no one came out, the cats crept through the open doors and walked mewing through the empty rooms. And then they went back to the fields and were wild cats from then on, hunting gophers and field mice and sleeping in ditches in the daytime. When the night came, the bats, which had stopped at the doors for fear of light, swooped into the houses and sailed about through the empty rooms, and in a little while they stayed in dark room corners during the day, folded their wings high, and hung head down among the rafters, and the smell of their droppings was in the empty houses. And the mice moved in and stored weed seeds in corners, in boxes, in the backs of drawers in the kitchens. And weasels came in to hunt the mice, and the brown owls flew shrieking in and out again. Now there came a little shower. The weeds sprang up in front of the doorstep, where they had not been allowed, and grass grew up through the porch boards. The houses were vacant, and a vacant house falls quickly apart. Splits started up the sheathing from the rusted nails. A dust settled on the floors, and only mouse and weasel and cat tracks disturbed it. On a night the wind loosened a shingle and flipped it to the ground. The next wind pried into the hole where the shingle had been, lifted off three, and the next a dozen. The midday sun burned through the hole and threw a glaring spot on the floor. The wild cats crept in from the fields at night, but they did not mew at the doorstep anymore. They moved like shadows of a cloud across the moon, into the rooms to hunt the mice. And on windy nights the doors banged, and the ragged curtains fluttered in the broken windows.
Chapter 12.
Highway 66 is the main migrant road. 66, a long concrete path across the country, waving gently up and down on the map from the Mississippi to Bakersfield, over the red lands and the gray lands, twisting up into the mountains, crossing the divide, and down into the bright and terrible desert, and across the desert to the mountains again, and into the rich California valleys. 66 is the path of a people in flight, refugees from dust and shrinking land, from the thunder of tractors and shrinking ownership, from the desert's slow northward invasion, from the twisting winds that howl up out of Texas, from the floods that bring no richness to the land and steal what little richness is there. From all of these, the people are in flight, and they come into 66 from the tributary side roads, from the wagon tracks and the rutted country roads. 66 is the mother road, the road of flight. Clarksville and Ozark and Van Buren and Fort Smith on 64, and there's an end of Arkansas. And all the roads into Oklahoma City, 66 down from Tulsa, 270 up from McAllister, 81 from Wichita Falls south, from Enid north, Edmond, McLeod, Purcell. 66 out of Oklahoma City, El Reno and Clinton, going west on 66, Hydro, Elk City, and Texola, and there's an end to Oklahoma. 66 across the panhandle of Texas, Shamrock and McLean, Conway and Amarillo, the Yellow, Wildorado and Vega and Boise, and there's an end of Texas. Tucumcari and Santa Rosa and into the New Mexican Mountains to Albuquerque, where the road comes down from Santa Fe. Then down the gorged Rio Grande to Los Lunas, and west again on 66 to Gallup, and there's the border of New Mexico. And now the high mountains, Holbrook and Winslow and Flagstaff in the high mountains of Arizona. Then the great plateau, rolling like a groundswell, Ash Fork and Kingman and Stone Mountains again, where water must be hauled and sold. Then out of the broken, sun-rotted mountains of Arizona to the Colorado, with green reeds on its banks, and that's the end of Arizona. There's California, just over the river, and a pretty town to start it. Needles on the river. But the river is a stranger in this place. Up from Needles, and over a burned range, and there's the desert. And 66 goes on over the terrible desert, where the distance shimmers and the black center mountains hang unbearably in the distance. At last, there's Barstow, and more desert, until at last the mountains rise up again, the good mountains, and 66 winds through them. Then, suddenly, a pass, and below the beautiful valley, below orchards and vineyards and little houses, and in the distance, a city, and, oh my God, it's over. The people in flight streamed out on 66, sometimes a single car, sometimes a little caravan. All day they rolled slowly along the road, and at night they stopped near water. In the day, ancient leaky radiators sent up columns of steam. Loose connecting rods hammered and pounded, and the men driving the trucks and the overloaded cars listened apprehensively. How far between towns? It is a terror between towns. If something breaks, well, if something breaks, we camp right here while Jim walks to town and gets a part and walks back, and how much food we got. Listen to the motor. Listen to the wheels. Listen with your ears and with your hands on the steering wheel. Listen with a palm of your hand on the gear shift lever. Listen with your feet on the floorboards. Listen to the pounding old jalopy with all your senses, for a change of tone, a variation of rhythm may mean a week here. That rattle, that's Tappets, don't hurt a bit. Tappets can rattle till Jesus comes again without no harm. But that thudding as the car moves along, can't hear that. Just kind of feel it. Maybe oil isn't getting someplace. Maybe a barren's starting to go. Jesus, if it's a barren, what'll we do? Money's going fast. And why's the son of a bitch heat up so hot today? This ain't no climb. Let's look. God almighty, the fan belt's gone. Here, make a belt out of this little piece of rope. Let's see how long. There. I'll splice the ends. Now take her slow. Slow, till we can get to a town. That rope belt won't last long. If we can only get to California, where the oranges grow before this here old jug blows up, if we only can. And the tires, two layers of fabric worn through, only a 4-ply tire. Might get 100 miles more out of her if we don't hit a rock and blow her. Which'll we take? 100, maybe, miles? Or maybe spoil the tube? Which? 100 miles. Well, that's something you gotta think about. We got tube patches. Maybe when she goes, she'll only spring a leak. How about making a boot? Might get 500 more miles. Let's go on till she blows. We got to get a tire, but Jesus, they want a lot for an old tire. They look a fella over. They know he got to go on. They know he can't wait, and the price goes up. Take it or leave it. I ain't in business for my health. I'm here selling tires. I ain't giving them away. I can't help what happens to you. I gotta think what happens to me. How far is the next town? I seen 42 cars of you fellas go by yesterday. Where you all come from? Where are you going? Well, California's a big state. It ain't that big. The whole United States ain't that big. It ain't that big. It ain't big enough. There ain't room enough for you and me, for your kind and my kind, for rich and poor together all in one country, for thieves and honest men, for hunger and fat. Why don't you go back where you come from? This is a free country. Fella can go where he wants. That's what you think. Ever hear of the Border Patrol on the California line? Police from Los Angeles? Stopped you bastards, turned you back. Says if you can't buy no real estate, we don't want you. Says, got a driver's license? Let's see it. Tore it up. Says you can't come in without no driver's license. It's a free country. Well, try to get some freedom to do. Fella says you're just as free as you got Jack to pay for it. In California, they got high wages. I got a handbill here tells about it. Baloney. I seen folks coming back. Somebody's kidding you. You want that tire or don't you? Got to take it, but Jesus, mister, it cuts into our money. We ain't got much left. Well, I ain't no charity. Take her along. Got to, I guess. Let's look her over. Open her up. Look at the casing. You son of a bitch, you said the casing was good. She's broke damn near through. The hell she is. Well, by George, how come I didn't see that? You did see it, you son of a bitch. You want to charge us $4 for a busted casing? I'd like to take a sock at you.
Now keep your shirt on. I didn't see it, I tell you. Here, tell you what I'll do. I'll give you this one for $350. You'll take a flying jump at the moon. We'll try to make the next town. Think we can make it on that tire? Got to. I'll go on the rim before I'd give that son of a bitch a dime. What do you think a guy in business is? Like he says, he ain't in it for his health. That's what business is. What do you think it was? Fellas got, see that sign alongside the road there? Service Club. Luncheon Tuesday, Kalmado Hotel? Welcome, brother. That's a service club. Fella had a story. Went to one of them meetings and told the story to all them businessmen. Says, when I was a kid, my old man give me a haltered heifer and says, take her down and get her serviced. And the fella says, I done it. And every time since then, when I hear a businessman talking about service, I wonder who's getting screwed. Fella in business got to lie and cheat, but he calls it something else. That's what's important. You go steal that tire, and you're a thief. But he tried to steal your $4 for a busted tire. They call that sound business. Danny in the back wants a cup of water. Have to wait. Got no water here. Listen, at the rear end? Can't tell. Sound telegraphs through the frame. There goes a gasket. Gotta go on. Listen to her whistle. Find a nice place to camp and I'll jerk the head off. But God almighty, the food's getting low. The money's getting low. When we can't buy no more gas, what then? Danny in the back seat wants a cup of water. Little fella's thirsty. Listen to that gasket whistle. Key rice, there she went. Blowed tube and casing all to hell. Have to fix her. Save that casing to make boots. Cut 'em out and stick 'em inside a weak place. Cars pulled up beside the road, engine heads off, tires mended. Cars limping along 66 like wounded things, panting and struggling. Too hot, loose connections, loose bearings, rattling bodies. Danny wants a cup of water. People in flight along 66, and the concrete road shone like a mirror under the sun. And in the distance, the heat made it seem that there were pools of water in the road. Danny wants a cup of water. He'll have to wait. Poor little fella. He's hot. Next service station. Service station, like the fella says. 250,000 people over the road. 50,000 old cars, wounded, steaming. Wrecks along the road, abandoned. Well, what happened to them? What happened to the folks in that car? Did they walk? Where are they? Where does the courage come from? Where does the terrible faith come from? And here's a story you can hardly believe, but it's true, and it's funny, and it's beautiful. There was a family of 12, and they were forced off the land. They had no car. They built a trailer out of junk and loaded it with their possessions. They pulled it to the side of 66 and waited. And pretty soon a sedan picked them up. 5 of them rode in the sedan, and 7 on the trailer, and a dog on the trailer. They got to California in 2 jumps. The man who pulled them fed them, and that's true. But how can such courage be, and such faith in their own species? Very few things would teach such faith. The people in flight from the terror behind. Strange things happen to them, some bitterly cruel, and some so beautiful that the faith is re-fired forever. Chapter 13. The ancient overloaded Hudson creaked and grunted to the highway at Salisaw and turned west, and the sun was blinding. But on the concrete road, Al built up his speed because the flattened springs were not in danger anymore. From Salisaw to Gore is 21 miles, and the Hudson was doing 35 miles an hour. From Gore to Warner, 13 miles. Warner to Chakota, 14 miles. Chakota a long jump to Henrietta, 34 miles, but a real town at the end of it. Henrietta to Castle, 19 miles, and the sun was overhead,
and the red fields, heated by the high sun, vibrated the air. Al at the wheel, his face purposeful, his whole body listening to the car, his restless eyes jumping from the road to the instrument panel. Al was one with his engine, every nerve listening for weaknesses, for the thumps or squeals, hums and chattering that indicate a change that may cause a breakdown. He had become the soul of the car. Grandma, beside him on the seat, half slept and whimpered in her sleep, opened her eyes to peer ahead, and then dozed again. And Ma sat beside Grandma, one elbow out the window and the skin reddening under the fierce sun. Ma looked ahead, too, but her eyes were flat and did not see the road or the fields, the gas stations, the little eating sheds. She did not glance at them as the Hudson went by. Al shifted himself on the broken seat and changed his grip on the steering wheel, and he sighed.
"Makes a racket, but I think she's all right. God knows what she'll do if we gotta climb a hill with the load we got. Got any hills tween here and California, Ma?"
Ma turned her head slowly, and her eyes came to life.
"Seems to me they's hills," she said. "Course I dunno. But seems to me I heard they's hills and even mountains, big ones."
Grandma drew a long, whining sigh in her sleep. Al said,
"We'll burn right up if we got climbing to do. Have to throw out some of this stuff. Maybe we shouldn't have brang that preacher."
"You'll be glad of that preacher before we're through," said Ma. "That preacher'll help us."
She looked ahead at the gleaming road again. Al steered with one hand and put the other on the vibrating gear shift lever. He had difficulty in speaking. His mouth formed the words silently before he said them aloud.
"Ma?"
She looked slowly around at him, her head swaying a little with the car's motion.
"Ma, you scared of going? You scared of going to a new place?"
Her eyes grew thoughtful and soft.
"A little," she said. "Only it ain't scared so much. I'm just a-settin' here waitin'. When something happens that I got to do something, I'll do it."
"Ain't you thinking what it's gonna be like when we get there? Ain't you scared it won't be nice like we thought?"
"No," she said quickly. "No, I ain't. You can't do that. I can't do that. It's too much. Livin' too many lives. Up ahead, there's 1,000 lives we might live, but when it comes, it'll only be one. If I go ahead on all of 'em, it's too much. You got to live ahead 'cause you're so young, but it's just the road going by for me. And it's just how soon they're gonna want to eat some more pork bones."
Her face tightened.
"That's all I can do. I can't do no more. All the rest'd get upset if I'd done any more than that. They all depend on me just thinking about that."
Grandma yawned shrilly and opened her eyes. She looked wildly about.
"I got to get out, praise God," she said.
"First clump of brush," said Al. "There's one up ahead."
"Brush or no brush, I gotta get out, I tell you."
And she began to whine.
"I gotta get out. I gotta get out."
Al speeded up, and when he came to the low brush, he pulled up short. Ma threw the door open and half pulled the struggling old lady out beside the road and into the bushes, and Ma held her so Grandma would not fall when she squatted. On top of the truck, the others stirred to life. Their faces were shining with sunburn they could not escape. Tom and Casey and Noah and Uncle John let themselves wearily down. Ruthie and Winfield swarmed down the sideboards and went off into the bushes. Connie helped Rose of Sharon gently down. Under the canvas, Grandpa was awake, his head sticking out, but his eyes were drugged and watery and still senseless. He watched the others, but there was little recognition in his watching. Tom called to him,
"Wanna come down, Grandpa?"
The old eyes turned listlessly to him.
"No,"
said Grandpa.
For a moment the fierceness came into his eyes.
"I ain't a-goin', I tell you. Gonna stay like muley."
And then he lost interest again. Ma came back, helping Grandma up the bank to the highway. "Tom," she said, "get that pan of bones under the canvas and back. We got to eat something." Tom got the pan and passed it around, and the family stood by the roadside, gnawing the crisp particles from the pork bones.
"Sure lucky we brang these along," said Pa. "Get so stiff up there, can't hardly move. Where's the water?"
"Ain't it up with you?" Ma asked. "I set out that gallon jug." Pa climbed the sides and looked under the canvas.
"It ain't here. We must have forgot it."
Thirst set in instantly. Winfield moaned,
"I want a drink. I want a drink."
The men licked their lips, suddenly conscious of their thirst, and a little panic started. Al felt the fear growing.
"We'll get water first service station we come to. We need some gas, too."
The family swarmed up the truck sides. Ma helped Grandma in and got in beside her. Al started the motor and they moved on. Castle to Payden, 25 miles, and the sun passed the zenith and started down. And the radiator cap began to jiggle up and down and steam started to whish out. Near Payden, there was a shack beside the road and two gas pumps in front of it, and beside a fence, a water faucet and a hose. Al drove in and nosed the Hudson up to the hose. As they pulled in, a stout man, red of face and arms, got up from a chair behind the gas pumps and moved toward them. He wore brown corduroys and suspenders and a polo shirt, and he had a cardboard sun helmet, painted silver, on his head. The sweat beaded on his nose and under his eyes and formed streams in the wrinkles of his neck. He strolled toward the truck, looking truculent and stern.
"You folks aim to buy anything? Gasoline or stuff?" he asked.
Al was out already, unscrewing the steaming radiator cap with the tips of his fingers, jerking his hand away to escape the spurt when the cap should come loose.
"Need some gas, mister."
"Got any money?"
"Sure. Think we're begging?"
The truculence left the fat man's face.
"Well, that's all right, folks. Help yourself to water."
And he hastened to explain.
"Road is full of people. Come in, use water, dirty up the toilet, and then, by God, they'll steal stuff and don't buy nothing. Got no money to buy with. Come begging a gallon gas to move on."
Tom dropped angrily to the ground and moved toward the fat man.
"We're paying our way," he said fiercely. "You got no call to give us a going over. We ain't asked you for nothing."
"I ain't,"
the fat man said quickly. The sweat began to soak through his short-sleeved polo shirt.
"Just help yourself to water and go use a toilet if you want."
Winfield had got the hose. He drank from the end and then turned the stream over his head and face and emerged dripping.
"It ain't cool," he said.
"I don't know what the country's coming to," the fat man continued.
His complaint had shifted now, and he was no longer talking to or about the Jodes.
50, 60 cars of folks go by every day. Folks all moving west with kids and household stuff. Where are they going? What they gonna do?"
"Doing the same as us," said Tom. "Going someplace to live, trying to get along, that's all."
"Well, I don't know what the country's coming to. I just don't know. Here's me trying to get along, too. Think any of them big new cars stops here? No, sir. They go on to them yellow-painted company stations in town. They don't stop no place like this. Most folks stop here ain't got nothing."
Al flipped the radiator cap, and it jumped into the air with a head of steam behind it, and a hollow bubbling sound came out of the radiator. On top of the truck, the suffering hound dog crawled timidly to the edge of the load and looked over, whimpering toward the water. Uncle John climbed up and lifted him down by the scruff of the neck. For a moment the dog staggered on stiff legs, and then he went to lap the mud under the faucet. In the highway the cars whizzed by, glistening in the heat, and the hot wind of their going fanned into the service station yard. Al filled the radiator with the hose.
"It ain't that I'm trying to get trade out of rich folks," the fat man went on. I'm just trying to get trade. Why, the folks that stops here begs gasoline, and then they trades for gasoline. I could show you in my back room the stuff they'll trade for gas and oil. Beds and baby buggies and pots and pans. One family traded a doll their kid had for a gallon. And what am I going to do with the stuff? Open a junk shop? Why, one fella wanted to give me his shoes for a gallon. And if I was that kind of fella, I bet I could get...
He glanced at Ma and stopped. Jim Casey had wet his head, and the drops still coursed down his high forehead, and his muscled neck was wet and his shirt was wet. He moved over beside Tom.
"It ain't the people's fault," he said. "How'd you like to sell the bed you sleep on for a tank full of gas?"
"I know it ain't their fault. Every person I talk to is on the move for a damn good reason. But what's a country coming to? That's what I want to know. What's it coming to? Fella can't make a living no more. Folks can't make a living farming. I ask you, what's it coming to? I can't figure her out. Everybody I ask, they can't figure her out. Fella wants to trade his shoes so he can get 100 miles on. I can't figure her out."
He took off his silver hat and wiped his forehead with his palm, and Tom took off his cap and wiped his forehead with it. He went to the hose and wet the cap through and squeezed it and put it on again. Ma worked a tin cup out through the side bars of the truck, and she took water to Grandma and to Grandpa on top of the load. She stood on the bars and handed the cup to Grandpa, and he wet his lips and then shook his head and refused more. The old eyes looked up at Ma in pain and bewilderment for a moment before the awareness receded again. Al started the motor and backed the truck to the gas pump. "Fill her up. She'll take about 7, said Al. "We'll give her 6 so she don't spill none." The fat man put the hose in the tank.
"No, sir," he said. "I just don't know what the country's coming to. Relief and all."
Casey said,
"I've been walking around in the country. Everybody's asking that. What we coming to? Seems to me... we don't never come to nothing. Always on the way. Always going and going. Why don't folks think about that? There's movement now. People moving. We know why. And we know how. Moving 'cause they got to. That's why folks always move. Moving 'cause they want something better than what they got. And that's the only way they'll ever get it. Wanting it and needing it. They'll go out and get it. It's being hurt that makes folks mad to fightin'. I've been walking around the country and hearing folks talk like you."
The fat man pumped the gasoline and the needle turned on the pump dial, recording the amount.
"Yeah, but what's it coming to? That's what I want to know."
Tom broke in irritably.
"Well, you ain't never gonna know. Casey tries to tell you, and you just ask the same thing over. I seen fellas like you before. You ain't asking nothing. You're just singing a kind of song. What we coming to? You don't want to know. Country's moving around, going places. There's folks dying all around. Maybe you'll die pretty soon, but you won't know nothing. I seen too many fellas like you. You don't want to know nothing. Just sing yourself to sleep with a song. What we coming to?"
He looked at the gas pump, rusted and old, and at the shack behind it, built of old lumber, the nail holes of its first use still showing through the paint that had been brave, the brave yellow paint that had tried to imitate the big company stations in town. But the paint couldn't cover the old nail holes and the old cracks in the lumber, and the paint could not be renewed. The imitation was a failure. And the owner had known it was a failure. And inside the open door of the shack, Tom saw the oil barrels, only 2 of them, and the candy counter with stale candies and licorice whips turning brown with age and cigarettes. He saw the broken chair and the fly screen with a rusted hole in it, and the littered yard that should have been graveled, and behind the cornfield, drying and dying in the sun. Beside the house, the little stock of used tires and retreaded tires. and he saw for the first time the fat man's cheap washed pants and his cheap polo shirt and his paper hat. He said,
"I didn't mean to sound off at you, mister. It's the heat. You ain't got nothing. Pretty soon you'll be on the road yourself. And it ain't tractors'll put you there. It's them pretty yellow stations in town. Folks is moving," he said ashamedly, "and you'll be moving, mister."
The fat man's hand slowed on the pump and stopped while Tom spoke. He looked worriedly at Tom.
"How'd you know?" he asked helplessly. "How'd you know we was already talking about packing up and moving west?"
Casey answered him.
"It's everybody," he said. "Here's me, that used to give all my fight against the devil, 'cause I figured the devil was the enemy. But they's something worse than the devil got hold of the country, and it ain't gonna let go till it's chopped loose. Ever see one of them Gila monsters take hold, mister? Grabs hold, and you chop him in two, and his head hangs on. Chop him at the neck, and his head hangs on. Got to take a screwdriver and pry his head apart to get him loose. And while he's laying there, poison is dripping and dripping into the hole he's made with his teeth."
He stopped and looked sideways at Tom. The fat man stared hopelessly straight ahead. His hand started turning the crank slowly.
"I dunno what we're coming to," he said softly.
Over by the water hose, Connie and Rose of Sharon stood together, talking secretly. Connie washed the tin cup and felt the water with his finger before he filled the cup again. Rose of Sharon watched the cars go by on the highway. Connie held out the cup to her.
"This water ain't cool, but it's wet," he said.
She looked at him and smiled secretly. She was all secrets now she was pregnant, secrets and little silences that seemed to have meanings. She was pleased with herself, and she complained about things that didn't really matter. And she demanded services of Connie that were silly. Both of them knew they were silly. Connie was pleased with her too, and filled with wonder that she was pregnant. He liked to think he was in on the secrets she had. When she smiled slyly, he smiled slyly too, and they exchanged confidences and whispers. The world had drawn close around them, and they were in the center of it. Or rather, Rose of Sharon was in the center of it, with Connie making a small orbit about her. Everything they said was a kind of secret. She drew her eyes from the highway.
"I ain't very thirsty," she said daintily, "but maybe I ought to drink."
And he nodded, for he knew well what she meant. She took the cup and rinsed her mouth and spat, and then drank the cupful of tepid water.
"Want another?" he asked. "Just a half."
And so he filled the cup, just half, and gave it to her. A Lincoln Zephyr, silvery and low, whisked by. She turned to see where the others were and saw them clustered about the truck. Reassured, she said,
"How'd you like to be going along in that?"
Connie sighed.
"Maybe. After."
They both knew what he meant.
"And if they's plenty work in California, we'll get our own car. But them,"
he indicated the disappearing Zephyr,
"them kind costs as much as a good-sized house.
I'd rather have the house."
"I like to have the house and one of them," she said. "But, course, the house would be first because..."
And they both knew what she meant. They were terribly excited about the pregnancy.
"You feel all right?"
he asked.
"Tarred. Just tarred riding in the sun."
"We got to do that, or we won't never get to California."
"I know," she said.
The dog wandered, sniffing past the truck, trotted to the puddle under the hose again and lapped at the muddy water. And then he moved away, nose down and ears hanging. He sniffed his way among the dusty weeds beside the road to the edge of the pavement. He raised his head and looked across, and then started over. Rose of Sharon screamed shrilly. A big, swift car whisked near, tires squealed,